Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. Whether you are a student prepping for tests and boards or a CRNA here to earn CEUs, we are glad you've joined us. For more about us, make sure to check us out on Instagram at Core Anesthesia and online at coreanesthesia.com.
Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. I'm Cole, here with Tanner, and today we're going to continue our discussion by moving into issues that can develop with the gastrointestinal system. So a couple of different things we're going to talk about. First of all, while this isn't exactly gastrointestinal, but just obesity and the changes in anesthetic that we're going to have to deal with when you have an obese patient, and we want to make sure that we're providing the best and adequate care for these patients. We're going to start with that. And the reason we're going to start with that is you often see some of these other things develop in relation to obesity. So we'll talk about GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. After that, we'll go into small bowel obstruction. We'll talk about pancreatitis, specifically acute pancreatitis. And then we'll end by talking about acute abdomen. And when patients come in with acute abdominal pain, just the differential diagnoses, the emergent procedures that we'd have to do, and what we'll do from the anesthesia side of things. So that's kind of the plan for today. So Tanner, do you just want to start us off with a rundown of obesity, the excess adipose tissue, what that's going to do from a pathophys standpoint?
When we think of obesity, it's important to remember that adipose tissue is actually considered an endocrine organ. So this organ is designed to provide a reservoir or a bank basically of energy and heat insulation. So we can use these adipose stores for energy, and our body can convert that to energy when we need it. Excess adipose tissue, however, becomes problematic for a few different reasons. These patients are more likely to develop insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes. You can see issues with obstructive lung disease. You can see hypercholesterolemia, coronary artery disease, hypertension. Oftentimes, you'll see that along with congestive heart failure as well. Many times when you take care of these patients, you'll notice that they have issues with obstructive sleep apnea. We mentioned that we'll be talking about GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, here in a little bit. You can also see issues with wound infections simply because of pressure with different skin folds and maybe decreased ability to care for those effectively. And so there's lots of different pathologies that come into play when we're talking about patients with obesity. And a lot of these things are cause and effect, causing other disease processes and many times work together. So it's important that we keep a lot of these things in mind as we think about how are we going to manage these patients? How are we going to care for them specifically from an anesthesia standpoint? It is important also to remember that depending on the way that the patient presents with different fat distributions, there are different things that are more likely to present as well. So we think about gynecoid obesity, and typically we think of this as the pear shape. So not as much distribution in the central location, but we see more around the hips and upper legs. Remember that typically, like I mentioned previously, adipose tissue is metabolically active and will require more oxygen, more energy. Gynecoid distribution, however, is metabolically inactive. So you see less systemic effects. On the flip side of this, android obesity. So we think of the apple shape here. So more fat buildup there in the central cavity, mainly abdominal fat buildup. That's going to be associated with more insulin resistance. You'll see increased blood pressure, heart disease. This type of adipose tissue is more metabolically active. And again, this is going to be associated with more of those systemic effects compared to the gynecoid obesity. Another thing that we talk about often here is metabolic syndrome. So these are patients that are increased risk for cardiovascular side effects. I want to mention the criteria for metabolic syndrome here. Criteria will include a waist circumference of above 40 centimeters for men and above 35 centimeters for women. Triglycerides above 150 milligrams per deciliter. Your HDL, your high density lipoprotein, will be below 40 for men and below 50 for women. Fasting glucose is above 100 milligrams per deciliter and blood pressure above 130 over 85 milligrams per mercury. You need at least three of these to be classified for metabolic syndrome. So again, waist circumference, triglycerides, HDL, your high density lipoprotein, your glucose levels, and then your blood pressure as well. At least three of those outside of those limits that we just mentioned, and that will be your classification for metabolic syndrome. Another thing that we use to help measure is going to be the body mass index. So this is going to be a way that we can measure the body with adipose tissue compared to just getting a strict weight. So now we'll be comparing their weight combined with the height of the patient. And so this formula is for the BMI is kilograms divided by height in meters squared. Remember that this is simply a tool. So oftentimes you'll see like really muscular patients that will come in that have a really high BMI. And you think, if you just look at the BMI, you think that they look like a very different patient than what they present as. Again, this is just taking the overall weight divided by the height. So it doesn't account for that muscle mass. So it needs to be taken with a grain of salt, but it is a better tool than just taking just their weight. You know that a patient presents very differently when they are 5 feet tall, weighing 300 pounds versus 6'5", weighing 300 pounds. And again, this BMI is going to be a helpful tool for us to evaluate that. Normal values here for your BMI, 18.5 to 24.9 is the normal value. Overweight is 25 to 30. Obese class 1 is 30 to 35. Class 2 is 35 to 40. Class 3 is above 40. And super obese is over 50. If you have a patient that is underweight, that is going to be less than 18.5. Again, for our reference range, normal value 18.5 to 24.9.
So next, let's talk about some of the disease processes and body systems that will be affected by obesity. So first of all, cardiovascular. In order for the blood supply to reach all the additional adipose tissues, patients will need a higher blood volume just simply to be able to get enough oxygen and blood flow to all the extra tissue that is available there. Now, the heart works harder in this case to get that cardiac output higher, which is then going to lead to an increased risk for ischemia. There's also an increased need for increasing the preload in order to have that extra cardiac output to be able to provide that extra blood volume to the tissues. So this increased preload is going to be needed, which means there's going to be an increased venous return from that increased volume. So everything's kind of increased and uplifted here. As a result, hypertrophy can develop in that left ventricle from pushing a higher stroke volume out, as well as fighting against what Tanner talked about as a common comorbidity, which is hypertension. So the heart not only is having to push more blood out, but it's doing it against a higher afterload from chronic hypertension. And so it's more at risk to develop hypertrophy. This results in a diastolic heart failure or dysfunction picture. And then as disease progresses over time, a systolic dysfunction can occur as well. On the right side of the heart specifically, then, any pulmonary hypertension that develops from that increase in blood volume then can result in right ventricular hypertrophy and failure, especially when you mix it with patients that are more at risk for hypoxia as well, simply because you have the obesity level and the extra weight kind of restricting the lungs. And I'll move into that here in a second. And depending on the severity of that ventricular hypertrophy, there can be either a right or a left axis shift or deviation that can be seen as well. One other note I want to mention with cardiovasculature, when you put these patients under anesthesia, or if they're just simply in the hospital on an EKG, that extra adipose tissue results in a lower voltage seen. So just keep in mind that you may not have quite as wide of a waveform with that voltage on your EKG. And then as I mentioned, moving into the respiratory system, the abdominal contents and any extra adipose tissue around that area is going to push up on the lungs, and it's going to reduce the pulmonary compliance. And remember, pulmonary compliance is the ability of the lungs to receive extra volume and not increase its pressure. So if we have a decreased pulmonary compliance here, that simply means the patient is not going to be able to take a deep breath, not going to be able to fill up with enough volume as they would with a patient who has less of that excess abdominal tissue pushing on the lungs. And so basically any air they do bring into their lungs is going to increase their airway pressures. And this is going to be seen as a restrictive process. So a few episodes ago, we talked about obstructive versus restrictive lung diseases. So this would kind of be matching that restrictive lung disease process where they have more of an inability to get air into the lungs. Additionally, their vital capacity and their total lung capacity is going to decrease. This makes sense. Again, they're not going to be able to fill those lungs with as much volume as somebody that doesn't have as much adipose tissue pressing and compressing onto those lungs. And then also, as Tanner mentioned, the excess adipose tissue is metabolically active, typically. And so this extra adipose tissue then means that we're going to need more oxygen in the body because more oxygen is being consumed through those metabolically active tissues. And as a result, then more carbon dioxide is being made. So we got to figure out a way to get rid of that excess carbon dioxide and also make sure that we're providing enough oxygen to those tissues to begin with. Usually the body is able to compensate here by increasing the minute ventilation, and this will keep the CO2 at normal values. Additionally, their expiratory reserve volume, their ERV, is going to be reduced, which then decreases the functional residual capacity. Because remember, their ERV is calculated into their FRC. So that functional residual capacity is going to be decreased, which specifically for us, we need to keep that in mind under anesthesia for these patients. They're going to be more prone to having a hypoxic or desaturated episode in a shorter amount of time when you induce anesthesia before you go ahead and secure an airway. So just know that that decreased functional residual capacity, that FRC, is really going to play a factor here. And then lastly, the closing capacity can be above their FRC if it drops enough. And what that means is that the small airways will collapse. That's what closing capacity is talking about, is when do the small airways collapse? And if the closing capacity is above their FRC, that means the small airways are going to collapse during simply normal breathing, and you're going to have a VQ mismatch occur, and this will increase the dead space. So they're not going to be able to get all the air out necessarily because those small airways collapse before they can get all of it out. So anesthesia considerations here. Obese patients are going to, again, as I talked about, have a smaller FRC. So they're going to also, when you compare that and combine that with having an increased oxygen demand for all the extra adipose tissues and metabolically active tissues, putting those two together, they're going to be at risk for a quicker desaturation. And also their extra upper airway tissue then increases the risk of obstructive sleep apnea. And remember, obstructive sleep apnea is the sensation of airflow for at least 10 seconds. And untreated OSA, obstructive sleep apnea, can turn into obesity hypoventilation syndrome, also known as Pickwickian syndrome. And this results in the same characteristics as sleep apnea, but there's also this chronic increase in their PaCO2, and especially above 45 millimeters of mercury during the daytime. So patients often will have this comorbidity associated with that decreased FRC, the increased oxygen demand, the increased upper airway tissue. All of this plays a role into making a more difficult mask ventilation, intubation, and you're doing this in a quicker amount of time because you don't have as much reserve built up for when you put these patients to sleep. So because of that, pre-oxygenation is key in these patients. With 100% FiO2, positive pressure ventilation, and instead of placing the patient supine where their FRC will decrease further and their closing capacity will increase further, we don't want to do that because they're already trended this way to begin with. We're going to put them in a head elevated laryngoscopy position, or the HELP position. Other people will do ramping position where they'll put blankets and stack them up in kind of like a ramp. Whatever gets them out of that supine position, some people will tilt the head of the bed up. We don't want them supine. And when you're doing a airway assessment on these patients preoperatively, also know that their neck circumference is the single best predictor of a problematic intubation. So the larger that neck circumference, the larger the predictor of a problematic intubation. Next, a complete airway assessment, as I just mentioned, should be done in the preoperative setting. And if you have any type of doubt that you are going to be able to secure that airway in a regular, timely fashion, you need to have other airway equipment ready to go, either a video laryngoscopy, a fiber optic intubation device. Both of those, if not even more, of difficult airway equipment should be at least close by and able to use if you get to a situation where you're having trouble either ventilating or intubating a patient. These patients also have an increased risk of GERD and hiatal hernias, which would then potentially warrant a rapid sequence induction or an RSI. But it's just important to note here that studies show this should not just simply routinely be performed because the patient is obese. So just because you're taking care of a patient with an elevated BMI, if they're classified as an obese patient, does not mean we necessarily have to do a rapid sequence induction. But we should specifically do them for these patients where we think that there is an increased risk of aspiration, which typically with the comorbidities associated with these patients would make them fall under that category. Once you do get the patient asleep, you've secured an airway. For the ventilator maintenance part of it, we want to keep 6 to 8 milliliters per ideal kilogram of body weight for their tidal volumes. So this is not based on their actual kilogram body weight. This is for their ideal kilogram body weight, 6 to 8 milliliters per kilogram. We also need to increase their minute ventilation to increase that CO2 release from the body as we're trying to get out that extra CO2 that's being produced. And this should be achieved by increasing the respiratory rate, but again, not the tidal volume, because we've already have an increased airway pressure in these patients, and we don't want to increase that much more with an elevated tidal volume. You also want to try to keep their FiO2 as low as possible to prevent absorption at atelectasis. But again, sometimes you need to keep it elevated in these patients. So if you don't want to maximize their FiO2 and they're dropping on their saturations, another good thing to use is an increase in PEEP values. Typically about 10 to 12 centimeters of water is recommended while keeping their plateau pressure under 30 centimeters of water. If you are going to do neuroaxial anesthesia with these patients and you're going to use intrathecal narcotics, or if you're going to be using an increased amount of IV opioids, just know that they have an increased risk here of delayed respiratory depression. And especially if you're using the IV narcotics, just know that they're already at an increased risk of obstructive sleep apnea, and you need to be able to keep a close eye on them and know there's a fine balance with how much narcotic you're giving them, especially under a sedation or a MAC procedure where they're supposed to be keeping spontaneous ventilation. And additionally here, the use of appropriate cuff size for BP is very important with these patients. Often we're having to use a different size cuffs. If you use a wrong size cuff, so let's say the cuff is too small, you're going to have a falsely elevated BP reading. And if the cuff is the other way around, the cuff is too large, you're going to have a falsely decreased BP reading. And to measure this, your cuff needs to encircle a minimum of 75% of the upper arm circumference is what we're looking for. Lipophilic drugs are going to have an increased volume of distribution, which makes sense, right? I mean, lipophilic means the drug loves lipid-soluble tissues, and so it's going to go into that extra adipose tissue. So you're going to have an increased volume of distribution with those drugs. But on the flip side, you also are going to have an increase in the volume of distribution of hydrophilic drugs. So drugs that are loving more of the water soluble, but not the lipids. And this makes sense because you're going to have an increased blood volume and cardiac output. And because of that, you're going to have a more increased volume of distribution for these drugs as well. But just know the lipophilic drugs will have a greater increase in volume of distribution. And then the higher amounts of adipose tissue, are going to keep the volatile agents that have a high tissue solubility, so like isoflurane, for example, are going to stay in the fat longer, and that's going to prolong the duration of action. So for this reason, sevoflurane or desflurane should be used for a faster emergence in these patients. Nitrous is typically avoided because it decreases the amount of oxygen or FiO2 that can be used. So typically these patients are unable to tolerate nitrous being included, but if they are able to tolerate it, go ahead and use a nitrous. And there is a need specifically when you're dosing drugs to look at dosing based on lean body weight. And then lastly, it's recommended that when you extubate these patients, they should have a continuous positive airway pressure device or CPAP device ready to go and put them on that or BiPAP in the immediate post-op environment.
We'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by Nurse Anesthesia of Maine, where excellence meets compassion. Established in 2003, Nurse Anesthesia of Maine has grown into a dynamic team of 30-plus CRNAs, serving 12 hospitals and ASCs with exceptional anesthesia services. Nurse Anesthesia of Maine is seeking qualified nurse anesthesiologists to join their outstanding team with competitive salaries, a robust benefit package, flexible schedules, and a commitment to community involvement. Explore Bangor, Maine, a vibrant city surrounded by stunning outdoor landscapes, with all the city conveniences yet within range of both mountain hikes and a beautiful Atlantic coast. It's perfect for work and family life. Elevate your career with Nurse Anesthesia of Maine. Visit www.namecrna.com for more information. That's www.namecrna.com.
All right, next I'm going to talk about gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD. GERD is going to occur when there is a failure for your body to prevent the stomach contents to come back up into the esophagus. So this is going to occur when the pressure there in your stomach is going to override that lower esophageal sphincter, And that's going to allow those stomach contents to go back up into the esophagus. Some issues that we see here with chronic GERD is that you will start to see an abnormal epithelial lining in the esophagus that will increase the risk for malignancy. This is occurring because you have continual damage to these tissues. And so when this damage occurs, it's replaced with columnar epithelium cells rather than stratified squamous cells. And that is going to, again, lead to an increased risk for malignancy. This is known as Barrett esophagus. Many times, this is the indication that the patient has really bad GERD and you're going to do an upper endoscopy on these patients. And they'll be looking at this lining to see how severe the GERD actually is, how much damage we see there in the esophagus. Symptoms with GERD, you can see coughing. You can see laryngitis, esophageal cancer. Many times they'll complain of chest pain. Many times this is a really common thing after an anesthetic, especially if you're going to have any kind of insufflation or you're going to be dealing with, many times if you're doing an EGD and you're seeing these patients afterwards and they're complaining of chest pain, it's obviously something that you're going to take very seriously and you're going to do your cardiac workup and make sure that you've crossed all your T's, checked, dotted all the I's. But many times a GI cocktail is the solution here because this chest pain, while it is very real and very painful, is simply a symptom of this GERD and these issues that they have ongoing. Typically for treatment for this, they'll be on pharmacological interventions with antacids. You'll see histamine 2 receptor blockers. You can see proton pump inhibitors, prokinetics. Many times these patients are going to be on these daily, and this will be a lifetime regimen that they'll be taking to manage this GERD. When we're doing anesthesia on these patients, it's important that while they may have, pretty mild symptoms because they're taking these different medications, we need to verify, one, are you still taking these medications? And two, how are your symptoms? How have they been lately? Have they been well controlled? Is this something that happens only after eating certain foods or doing certain exercises? Or is this something that you will deal with every single day? Every time you lay flat, are you having symptoms of GERD? Are you having GERD throughout the day, whether you're eating or not? Are you having it just sometimes? All these questions are important to get to the bottom of how significant are these patients' GERD symptoms, and are we going to need to alter our anesthetic management because of this? If these patients have increased symptoms with GERD, then they're going to be at increased risk for aspiration during anesthesia. As soon as we take away the airway reflexes, then these patients, if they already have a known history of, like we mentioned, the very definition of it is that the stomach contents, that pressure is going to override that lower esophageal sphincter. That's going to cause contents to move back up into the esophagus. And then that ultimately could lead to going into their lungs with aspiration. So this is going to be something that that they could be at a higher risk if they have significant GERD symptoms. So what are we going to do to manage this? An RSI is recommended for patients that have uncontrolled GERD. If you are doing a general anesthetic with these patients, an endotracheal tube is going to be preferred over an LMA simply because now we have a controlled, secured airway and decreased risk for aspiration. When managing these patients, it's important that they continue their medications through the perioperative environment. If they're not on their medications, then it's important to get their med list and know what they're taking, and we can administer those. Again, pre-op, intra-op, post-op, all going to be times that we can intervene different ways with managing their GERD. Another really important thing to think about when you are inducing anesthesia is it's so important to make sure that we have suction, always, for sure. But especially when we're talking about patients with GERD, that we definitely want to make sure that we have our suction on working close by. So if they would have an event where they are having that reflux, then we are ready and prepared to manage that. One more thing that we can do for these patients after you induce is to put a OG tube down or a gastric tube to decompress the stomach, empty of all the contents. You can do this either at the beginning for decompression or before extubation. But again, everything that we can do to try to manage this risk of having the ultimate aspiration and those acidic contents going into the lungs. Important to evaluate the severity, important to evaluate their compliance with medication regimen, important to evaluate how they're feeling that day even, and then keep in mind the strategies we can use to mitigate that.
So next, let's talk about small bowel obstructions. And what this is typically a small bowel obstruction is going to be a blockage in the small intestine, which is going to result in ischemia to the bowel, necrosis, and potentially sepsis that can develop. So how does this happen? So most often, this is caused by adhesions from a previous abdominal surgery. Otherwise, it could also be caused by incarcerated hernias or metastasis from other cancerous tumors, etc. But most often, it's caused by a previous abdominal surgery and the adhesions from that. And typically then, once those adhesions kind of stick together, so to speak, and make an obstruction or a blockage in the small intestine, the small bowel obstruction then will initially start with abdominal distension proximal to that obstruction due to the collection of the fluid and gas that's in the small bowel lumen. This creates then more pressure on the inside of the lumen, which causes an increase in the secretory function of the small bowel, which then attracts fluid from the capillaries and pulls them and moves them towards the bowel lumen. So it further then increases pressure in the lumen, and additional fluid that's pulling in there, getting into the third space between the cells and the lining, et cetera. And so if you can envision, you have this blockage, and then prior to that blockage, you start to have this buildup and this basically insufflation, so to speak, and this enlargement of the small intestine. And once that intraluminal pressure continues to get greater and greater, and once it becomes greater than 20 centimeters of water, now it's going to start to compress the intestinal arterioles and capillaries, which are flowing through the lining of the lumen. So now you're blocking and compressing the blood flow to those tissues, which is now going to result in the ischemia to the bowel tissues. Potentially then, as you continue to increase this pressure, the bowel wall permeability will then start to increase. So like the lining becomes more fragile. You can either get a complete perforation, or you can just continue to have leakage, and potentially you get intestinal microbes that can get out of the lumen and into the peritoneal cavity, which then causes infection and sepsis. So with an upper bowel obstruction, additionally, there's going to be a loss of hydrogen, potassium, chloride. These patients are going to be most likely vomiting continually, and they continue to collect more and more fluid and particles through the bowel and gas into this proximal area. And you can see that this becomes a further problem unless we can get rid of this obstruction. So if patients come in with this small bowel obstruction, they're first treated, as long as they're stable and they haven't been progressed too far into this process, they're first going to be treated with non-surgical interventions if it's caught early enough in the process, such as allowing the bowel to rest by remaining the patient MPO, placing a nasal gastric tube to suction, providing fluid resuscitation and electrolyte abnormality corrections intravenously. Doing these things, and typically within 48 to 72 hours, that obstruction will be cleared. However, in about 25% of the cases, that obstruction does not resolve itself. And surgery is then going to be performed after that 48 to 72 hour mark of those interventions not working, or if the patient is continuing to progress into more of a septic picture. So patients who have progressed to this point to an infection or sepsis, they can present with hypotension, tachycardia, a decreased systemic vascular resistance because their capillary linings, the glycocalyx in their linings are becoming damaged just due to the sepsis. They're having fluid leak out into the third space. They're having an elevated hematocrit just due to hemoconcentration because, again, all that fluid is in the bowel. I mean, we're talking several liters of fluid that's in the bowel at this point. And then you have the third spacing systemically when they go into a septic picture. And these patients then are going to be hypovolemic in their vasculature. And you can just see this picture is not a good picture by the time they get down to surgery for us. And so during anesthesia, our goal here is to provide fluid resuscitation, stabilize their pH balance, any electrolyte abnormalities. Our goal is to maintain blood pressure, again, first by doing the fluid resuscitation and then potentially having to do vasopressors as well. And when we go into surgery, then we're obviously going to clear that obstruction. The patients will already be on antibiotics typically at this point to be treating the sepsis. Our goal simply here is to try to stabilize and correct any of the fluid imbalances and electrolyte imbalances and maintain a hemodynamics stable picture throughout the surgical procedure. Depending on the case of when they come down to us, how far into the septic picture they are. They may go back to the ICU intubated still. They may not. It's kind of a case-by-case basis. But again, here, our goal is just simply you may be getting an ABG, figuring out what their pH balances are, their base deficit, an elevated lactic due to the tissue necrosis. Our goal is just to try to stabilize and correct any of those abnormalities during the procedure.
All right, two more. We're going to go through pancreatitis now, and then we'll go through an acute abdomen, and that'll wrap up this episode. But first, let's talk about pancreatitis. So pancreas is an organ that lies behind the stomach and really serves two important functions. First, it's going to provide exocrine digestive enzymes to assist in the breakdown of food there in the digestive tract. And then it's also an endocrine hormone regulator. So you're going to be having it produce your glucagon and your insulin that are going to control your plasma glucose levels. And typically we think of those two functions being the primary functions there of the pancreas and what really will play the largest important role in our body systems. When we think about pancreatitis, so now we've got an issue with inflammation in the pancreas. We can see this because of chronic alcohol abuse. We can see direct trauma to the pancreas and infection, or gallstones are some other reasons that you could see pancreatitis. Gallstones are going to be something that I'll talk about here in just a second, a little bit further, but something that we very frequently see in the hospital when we're trying to manage these patients. And ultimately that's going to be causing obstruction there, the pancreatic duct. And then those enzymes are going to be causing the inflammation there in the pancreas, where typically those would be useful for breakdown of food, like I mentioned. But again, that's going to be leading to the inflammation there in the pancreas. If the inflammation of the pancreas continues to develop, then you can see cardiovascular and respiratory effects here. You can even see myocardial infarction. You can see acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. It can even lead to DIC as well. First-line treatment for these patients are going to be centered around managing their fluid and electrolytes. These patients many times will present with severe nausea and vomiting. And so with that vomiting, you can see hypokalemic alkalosis. And so you can see this patient that is very dehydrated. And then again, we'll have electrolyte abnormalities. And so it's important to manage those so that we don't have issues with cardiovascular issues such as arrhythmias and things like that with the different electrolytes. When we mentioned about the different reasons that we can see pancreatitis, you can see this again from alcohol abuse, trauma, infection, gallstones. If the issue is with the gallbladder, then you can perform a cholecystectomy. And this is going to be a treatment here for the gallbladder. So it's going to be removing the gallbladder. If it's simply just from ductal stones, then you can perform an ERCP to clear the stone. And this is, again, a very common procedure that we see in the operating room, that we'll see these patients come in very symptomatic, very sick, and simply by doing the ERCP, see quite a resolution. Hypocalcemia is often seen because of the release of free fatty acids that bind to calcium. And so it's important that we are paying attention to our risk factors or our signs and symptoms of hypocalcemia as well. If pancreatitis continues to develop, then you can see hyperglycemia, and this can lead also to multi-organ failure as well. It's important that when we're managing these patients, we are taking a multimodal approach. So we're checking blood sugars, we're making sure that we're managing electrolytes, fluids, and then again, getting them as quickly as possible to the ultimate treatment, whether that's, you know, taking out their gallbladder or doing an ERCP to resolve the issue. But it's important that we look at all these different pathways that could be affected because of this pancreatitis. If we are going to be removing the pancreas, so this is going to be a surgical removal of the pancreas, then there are several things that we'll want to consider for the anesthetic here. Oftentimes, these patients are presenting with severe acute abdominal pain, and again, very nauseated. Many times they're vomiting. RSI is going to be the preferred intubation technique simply because of the increased aspiration risk. You can also place a nasogastric tube to decompress the stomach. You can leave that in if you want to get fluids through the NG tube. That's also a possibility there too. But oftentimes this is going to be a staple here that we place during the anesthetic. We're going to want to try to resuscitate these patients. Again, we already mentioned that many times they are hypovolemic, and with hypovolemia, oftentimes you'll see them being hypotensive as well. So you'll want to aggressively resuscitate them from a fluid standpoint with crystalloids and colloids as well. you're also going to treat their electrolyte disorders. I already mentioned you can see hypocalcemia. Many times these patients will have low magnesium as well, hypokalemia. You can see a hypochloremic metabolic alkalosis because of that increased vomiting. So we should be paying attention to that as well. And then many times, again, with electrolyte abnormalities, you need to be thinking about your EKG changes as well. So any ischemic changes should be monitored there on the ECG. One more thing to mention here is that after we remove the pancreas, the peripheral insulin receptors will be upregulated and they will be causing the patient to be more sensitive here to insulin. And so important to keep that in mind after we remove the pancreas. Again, they're higher sensitivity to insulin so that we don't see this patient go into a, you know, low blood sugar crisis there. So keep that in mind.
Lastly, let's talk about acute abdomen. And what is an acute abdomen? This is when a patient presents with a rapid onset of severe abdominal pain. Now, obviously, there is a wide range of potential causes of this. Some of them can be life-threatening. So it's very important that we try to diagnose some of these life-threatening diagnoses quickly and get them to surgery if need be. And so some of the life-threatening causes of severe rapid onset abdominal pain would be a ruptured aortic aneurysm, an aortic dissection, perforated bowel, myocardial infarction, an acute pancreatitis, acute cholangitis, a ruptured ectopic pregnancy, a bowel obstruction, etc. So it's really important that we do abdominal ultrasounds and abdominal x-ray imaging quite immediately to be able to rule out any life-threatening causes, as what I just mentioned. Other less life-threatening causes can include acute appendicitis, cholecystitis, gastrointestinal bleed, etc. There's lots of different causes for abdominal pain. The location of the abdominal pain, depending on which quadrant, like upper left, upper right, lower left or right, typically we can kind of lump some of the causes into each of those. So that kind of helps. But again, we really need to get the imaging, either ultrasound or x-ray imaging, to rule out some of these life-threatening diagnoses. Lab values such as a BNP, a CBP, lactate levels should be drawn right away. A lactate over 4 mmol/L indicates that there's some tissue hypoxia, so potentially from an ischemic bowel. An elevated white blood cell count indicates an infection. Your arterial blood gas should be drawn to consider if there's any acid-base abnormalities, base deficit, potential hypoxemia levels. Again, we're just trying to figure out if there is any life-threatening complications that need to be resolved quickly. And in the case that there is, and the patient is rushed to surgery, we're going to be thrown into a case here on an emergent or urgent level. And what we need to do from our standpoint, if this does happen, is again, hopefully the emergency department has gotten these imaging already and has already sent off most of these labs. So we need to be doing a quick review of all these labs. And the goal should be to stabilize their acid-base level during our anesthetic, to correct any fluid deficit that occurs, any electrolyte abnormalities, provide hemodynamic stability, and assume that all these patients with an acute abdomen are going to be severely dehydrated until proven otherwise. So we want to have 2 large bore IVs in case we need to give any blood products rapidly, again, fluid resuscitation. Any of those involvements, we need at least 2 large bore IVs, and potentially you're going to be putting in a central line to get better access to be able to give more volume to these patients. Induction should be performed with an RSI. Assume the patient is a full stomach, and the patients are often left intubated and taken to the intensive care unit, the ICU, after the procedure. So again, the specifics here are going to depend on a case-by-case or patient-by-patient basis, but for the most part, our goal simply here, when they're opening up the patient, probably laparoscopically at first, figure out the cause and then potentially going open, is going to be making sure that we are resuscitating them from a fluid standpoint. They're going to be dehydrated, almost always severely dehydrated. Their electrolyte imbalances are going to be off. So it's very important that if there was not an ABG drawn already, we're getting an ABG. We're trying to restabilize that pH balance, provide hemodynamic stability, limit any more hypoxia to the tissues that are going to continue to increase that lactic acid level. So that's going to wrap us up for this episode. Hopefully that is giving you more insight as to some of these gastrointestinal or abdominal urgent or emergent procedures that we may do. I know it's a little bit more of an overview. Again, each patient on a case-by-case basis will vary in terms of exactly how we'll have to alter our anesthetic. But for the most part, hopefully this has given you more of an insight and clarity as into what to look for and some major goals to do for our anesthetic for these patients.